KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. Welcome to the inaugural episode for the fall 2014 quarter. My name is Dave Levine. I am an associate professor at Elon University School of Law and affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. It's been a very busy fall for me as I've been focusing on a variety of advocacy and writing projects, and I'm thrilled to be back behind a microphone beginning another quarter on Hearsay Culture, where we dive deeply into issues involving communications, technology, intellectual property, social media, and the like. And what a better way, or there wouldn't be a better way, to start off than with our guest today, Virginia Commonwealth University Professor David Galumbia, author of the 2009 book, The Cultural Logic of Computation, and more recently writing on this fascinating issue and challenge of what he is calling cyber libertarians. In fact, in late 2013, he had an article in the online magazine Jacobin entitled Cyber Libertarians, Digital Deletion of the Left. David's work is quite interesting because, as we're going to talk about, he takes on in his writing, although I don't think it's necessarily by design, but it's certainly by implication and his focus, many of the somewhat sacrosanct and certainly high-profile entities operating in the advocacy world as well as the theoretical world of technology today. So everyone from the Electronic Frontier Foundation on the left to their counterparts on the right are I don't want to use too much radio and media hyperbole, but I'll simply say of interest to David and his work. In his Cyber Libertarians work, which we're going to be focusing on today and which is the subject of a book that he is working on now, what he takes a close look at, I think, is perhaps best summarized by the subtitle of the article in Jacobin, Technological Innovation Does Not Inherently Promote the Left's Goals, And, you know, of course, we're talking left-right in a political sense, but what, you know, is going on behind the scenes here is this interesting, I think, confluence of advocacy and civil society groups dealing with the fact that policies, particularly on a narrow and individualized basis, may in fact align with interests that we don't normally think of as aligned. And when I think about these issues from a policy standpoint, I'm reminded of the work that I and others did opposing the Stop Online Piracy Act. And while I was definitely strongly personally viewing SOPA as not the right solution to the problem of copyright infringement, particularly online, I had the pleasure of working with Mark Lemley and David Post, who may not agree on many things, but certainly agreed that that regulation didn't work well. That was a situation where academics were working together, of course, academics that may or may not have connections to private industry. But in the work of cyber libertarianism, what David is focusing on here is a question of what democracy looks like in the policy arena of technology, who, in fact, are the interests that we're talking about, what this notion of libertarianism and the idea of regulation or lack thereof on the internet and with technology more broadly might mean. And as we get into that discussion, we're going to be talking about what structures exist within policymaking and within regulatory systems that may or may not work to achieve the policy goals that we think are being advocated by individuals and entities. So it's very interesting work, I think extremely timely, and work that I'm very excited to discuss today. As I mentioned, David is a professor at VCU. He is the author of the 2009 book, The Cultural Logic of Computation. His work has been highly influential on many people who have also been on this show, including Frank Pasquale of Maryland Law. He is joining us via Skype from his home in Richmond, Virginia. We are recording on October 15th, 2014. And I thank you, David, for being here today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a wonderful opportunity.
So, David, let me start off with the question that I, as you know, I ask most of my guests. Tell us a bit more about your background and why you started focusing on cyber libertarianism before we defined it.
Sure. Well, I was one of those people with a little bit of a split mind. I was always interested in math and science on the one hand and, you know, literature and culture on the other. And I did my graduate work in English in the early 1990s, late 1980s. And for a lot of reasons, instead of taking a job in the academy, I went to work on Wall Street in the financial information sector, where I worked for about a decade as a software developer. And I enjoyed that a great deal. I learned so much, and it was the first dot-com bubble, which really gave me a lot of experience with the way a lot of different actors in our society perceive the digital revolution. But, you know, as I was working there, it really became clear to me that my heart was in being an academic. And part of why that happened that's kind of interesting is that most of the middle-level workers in technology, especially back then, tended to have broad educations, liberal arts educations for the most part. And we would talk a lot about college, and many of them would encourage me to go back and be a professor. They would say, being a professor is so hard to do, and college was the one time in life when I could talk about politics in an open way, and I really find I can't do that anymore, just throwing ideas around. And these people, for the most part, were really skeptical of the digital revolution. I mean, the talk around the office, was, look at how we are taking people's privacy away without recognizing it. Look at these giant computer systems that we are building that manipulate people's data behind the scenes in ways that they don't even see, and then we're selling it to them as this great benefit to them. And I was able to sort of integrate some of the work that I'd been doing, which was not about computers, in my graduate work, with some of this thinking about computers, and in that way I became a kind of English department expert on digital media. And what we do in English departments today is kind of read any kind of what we would call a text, from a novel to a movie to a TV show to a game, but also to any kind of sort of cultural event, and we kind of read it for what is implicit. Read it for what might be happening politically, around the edges, what we can see when we read closely. And what I found was that it was very intriguing to read the material surrounding the computer revolution in this way. And it could be read that way, which in the late 1990s was not even obvious, but it became pretty clear to me. And so I went back to being an academic and being an English professor, really. And one of the things that I found surprising that maybe we can talk about a little bit is that I remember when I went into one of my first meetings at my first job as an English professor at the University of Virginia, and where the subject was digital media. And I walked into that meeting and I was so excited. I thought, here, I'm going to have colleagues around who share my skepticism about the politics of the digital world. And instead, what I said to myself was, I am now in the client meeting from hell. I have the most enthusiastic, sort of starry-eyed people about what is happening with the digital, even than I used to have in business. It was really shocking to me how, and that was only in a gap of maybe 5 or 6 years where I wasn't that involved with the academy. So, that is something we were talking about before. It isn't that terrific to be a skeptical person about a lot of the digital stuff even in the academy today, which I find quite surprising. At the same time, it seems like it's a necessary thing to do. And
well, let me interrupt you, David, and ask you about that since you bring it up, because I think it is an important issue, and it's something that is at least at this point in mid-October 2014 getting some attention. We've seen recently the work of people like Evgeny Morozov, who's getting some criticism right now for some alleged plagiarism on blogs. Nick Carr, Mark Barrowline has been on the show. Others, and these people, are always asked this question: are you Luddites? Right? And Luddite, which has suddenly become almost a cute term, certainly I think overused for people that are against technology. And of course, it's really not that binary. Nor is it fair to suggest that, as you point out, that skeptics are somehow against the trends of history and are going to be on the wrong side of things. As someone who, before we even talk about your work, to the extent you want to comment on it, as someone who, at least as I mentioned in my introduction, has taken on, some of the large entities, at least to the extent of asking questions about where interests might align and how different groups work together, what has been your experience in even raising the question, much less taking the position?
it is a challenge. It's a challenge, and you know, in one way, the fact that it's a challenge gives you a, you know, makes you feel like it's important to do it. And you mentioned people like Morozov and Nicholas Carr, both of whom I admire a great deal. You know, I agree with most of what Morozov writes. I'm not sure his style of self-presentation is always completely helpful to him getting his message across, but you know, his analyses I generally agree with. You do encounter that exact what happens is, and this is kind of relevant to the work, that you get this framing where you get told, especially by people with a lot of stuff, money and other things invested in the technological revolution, either you are with us or you are a Luddite, and you are completely against us. And that's the effect of that is to say, so since you're completely against us, what you're saying is irrelevant and we don't need to consider it, and we should just go on doing whatever we are doing. And you know, that's completely unfair, really, right? What we are doing is trying to say people, in addition to those who have a lot of power, you know, like Google and other, and Facebook and other major corporations and so forth, they are openly advertising that they are changing really central fundamental aspects of society. And people like me and Morozov and Frank Pasquale and others are saying, if you're going to change stuff that's that central, it can't just be in the hands of the people who benefit from it, monetarily especially, to make those decisions. That isn't how we understand the democratic experiment to have been structured, right? When you're going to change fundamental things about society, in some way or other, everybody has to have a chance to weigh in, or, you know, at least their representatives have to have a chance to weigh in. And, you know, it's interesting just to reflect for a minute on the Luddite thing, right? Who were the Luddites, right? The Luddites themselves were not actually anti-technology. They were anti certain kinds of technology that were taking away jobs, right? And they were actually in favor of other technologies. They themselves were not, you know, anti-technology, whatever, you know, people who want to go live on a farm and like never have a telephone or something, right? So even the use of that term kind of, you know, it turns the debate into a black and white thing, where I think most people, if you ask them from another perspective, do you think, like, let's take Google's motto, organizing the world is information, right? If you ask somebody, do you think that organizing the world's information should be in the hands of a single, extremely powerful for-profit company, or should it be something that many of us decide together? I think most people would go for the latter, right? Like, that's a really important task. It can't just be in sort of one group, one interested group's hands. But what happens is you start to, you know, that position gets kind of left out in the debate, right? It's either you're with us or you're against us and you're irrelevant.
So we're chatting with David Golombia of VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, David, this is fascinating. We're going to come back to, you know, this critique of policymaking, which has increasingly become a focus on Hearsay Culture because, you know, much like, you know, my friend and mentor Larry Lessig, I think, you know, I my own experience inside government going back now a couple of decades, you know, indicates that if we don't have a process that works to get a range of views into a decision-making system that is not itself captured by money or otherwise, you're not going to get the policies that we want to drive information technology and information sharing and innovation and so forth. And so let me ask this question, you know, as we frame this discussion a bit more, because I will come back to that. So in your Jacobin piece, you describe, you define very simply cyber libertarianism as, quote, a view that widespread computerization naturally produces democracy and freedom. So perhaps you could explain in more detail what you mean by that. How do you define this idea of not just libertarianism, but cyber libertarianism?
Right. I, you know, the reason I use the word cyber libertarianism is that it was developed by the work of some really good media studies scholars in the 1990s, right? And principally among them, I think, and the best known is Langdon Winner, who's a Rochester Institute of Technology philosopher, essentially, and a wonderful writer on technology. And there's a problem with this word, because cyber libertarian, what it suggests to people is libertarian politics plus cyber, right? So it suggests people, like, let's say something like Ron Paul, and very interested in technology. But when you read this, what I say in the quote you just read, and if you read Winner's work and other people's work, that isn't really what they mean by the word, right? That would be, all that would be is technology-friendly political libertarian, of whom there are many, right? And I'm sure we will talk about that. Mm-hmm. But the word cyber-libertarian is meant to point at people who think what they are doing doesn't fall necessarily into any political camp. It's kind of neutral. And all they need to do is focus on building the technology, the digital technology in particular, and that in itself will produce some kind of political, social good. They usually attach the word freedom to it, right? But it's significantly underthought. It isn't people who have spent a lot of time reading John Locke and Thomas Jefferson and things like that. They just kind of know that if they keep tweeting out the right hashtag or putting the right stuff up on Facebook, like, the world is going to become more democratic. And what Winner points to is especially that word freedom, right? The word freedom, if we read deeply into 20th century political history, the word freedom comes to have some very different meanings depending on who's saying it. And in particular, what I think it's fair to call the far right, which is sometimes associated with that word libertarianism, and which probably has its origins in people from the Austrian school of economics like Friedrich von Hayek and Ludwig von Mises. When they talk about freedom, they are talking mostly about the freedom of the economic actor to do whatever they want without being restricted in those actions by government. And in the most extreme version of that, which probably comes in so-called anarcho-capitalist Murray Rothbard, but is visible in Hayek as well. The view is that government has a special power, which they call coercion, and only government can use this power, only government has this power, and government's use of power, that power is, first of all, it's horrible, right? It's a power that should never be used, and it's different in kind from what corporations can do. And they even will sometimes use, say sometimes even that power is violent, and that government has a monopoly on violence, and its coercive monopoly on violence is the opposite of freedom, right? And, you know, we could go into that a lot more, but mm-hmm. if we look at what some other political traditions have called freedom, like, let's say, somebody like Martin Luther King, right? Martin Luther King does not look at government and say, well, the only thing that does is to violently coerce people away from being free, right? Martin Luther King is going to look at government and say, actually, government guarantees certain rights, you know, which are to some extent in the Bill of Rights, but are also located in other places. But for Martin Luther King, became civil rights as well, right? And civil rights is one of the issues where this really gets interesting, I think. The government guarantees rights in a way that nobody else can. That is what's unique about government, is its ability to step in among actors who have a lot of other interests and say, look, there's a base here. You can't discriminate against people based on race. You can't discriminate against people based on gender. And now the word we sometimes associate with that is equality, right? But for people not on the far political right, that kind of equality is very close to what we might call freedom. It's a very different kind of freedom from the economic freedom over on the other side. And to go back to Winner again a little bit, part of Winner's point is that you get a lot of people in the technology world talking about the technology producing freedom and not really having a lot more to say about it than that, but working very hard toward it. And the analysis that I'm trying to build on is to look at that and saying, look, that is actually endorsing and giving power to something like a libertarian politics, even though it doesn't appear to be, right? It doesn't appear to have necessarily any politics at all.
We're chatting with David Columbia on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Yeah, that critique David, you know, I think is one that we're starting to hear, among the transparency skeptics or people that are questioning how much access information really does for us, particularly, if the beginning and end of all of it is simply put information out there. And in a sense, that's, I think, part of this critique you have of this libertarian notion of, as you point out, letting technology have its way, which inevitably leads to good. Related to this concept of cyber libertarianism that we're going to be focusing on today is a phrase that you use that I wanted to explore as well, and it particularly ties into, you know, a heavy focus of hearsay culture on intellectual property and innovation theory, which is this phrase, permissionless innovation. What is, again, by your definition, permissionless innovation? Because to me, it sounds like, I guess, fair use, but it could be more than that. It could be some kind of implied license, and this is the lawyer coming out of me. So I don't want to define it for you. I'd like you to define it. But then how does permissionless innovation, as you define it, tie into your critique of cyber libertarianism?
Well, I think that's a good example of how this all works, right? The origins of that phrase are a little bit obscure, but the way it is currently used, the permission that is being mentioned there is the permission granted by government, mm-hmm. right? And what is targeted specifically is government regulation. And the idea of permissionless innovation, I think, has a little bit less to do with intellectual property than with other forms of technological innovation. The idea is that you should not have to appeal to government prior to doing your technological innovation, whatever it is, before you unleash it on the public, right? That you should not have to ask permission. And even in that phrase, there's a kind of, inherent description of the state as a nanny that is kind of, standing, watching over you, deciding what it will and will not grant permission to. And one of the most recent examples of that phrase being used explicitly is from the George Mason University Mercatus Center, that is has paid a lot of attention to drones, right? And they talked a lot about permissionless innovation in a letter that they wrote to the FAA that was asking that the FAA not try to prohibitively regulate drone flights in the United States, although there already is some regulation. They were asking them really to get rid of it. But also not to try to come up with regulations beforehand, but to simply let the companies that want to create drones go and create them and do whatever they want with them. And then the argument they gave was that, well, and then if there are problems, we will figure that out. Mm-hmm. Right. And so permissionless innovation on its face, it doesn't sound like a political phrase, right? It sounds just like maybe a stance toward regulation, or, if most people that I've talked about with have no idea that might have anything to do with politics, right? But it doesn't take a lot of drilling down into the thought to say, so what you're saying is government regulatory bodies like the FAA shouldn't exercise their power, right? And that, of course, that government regulatory body was created by the democratic process. And so the permissionless innovation argument is government should stop doing its work. And, in the drone example, I think it would be terrible for the FAA simply to step back and let people do whatever they want. I mean, just for the privacy considerations alone, the idea that we could have these machines flying all around the airspace, potentially looking inside our houses, which, of course, people would do. We know how people act with digital tools, right? That is not the right way to go, right? And it is surprising to me even that we can have, that we're even having this debate, right? If the people who advocate the permissionless innovation stuff kind of act as if America has always been this nightmarish body of regulations that prevent innovators from doing what they want. And, it's just untrue. We have had a lot of industries that were allowed to create themselves without regulation. And time again, the result has been people going too far and creating immense damage, right? I am old enough to remember when the Great Lakes and many of the rivers in this country were so polluted that you could not go into them. Mm-hmm. And the industries that were doing that pollution fought tooth and nail against every item of regulation that was come up with. And, thank God that regulation worked. And, you know, it did get outside of regulatory capture, which is something that you've mentioned. And we were actually able to clean up some of those waterways. But you don't need to look much further than that to see that, you know, there is an important role for government in safeguarding the public good. And even, you know, one might say, well, polluting the waterways is a lot more harmful than like what you can do with digital tools. I think that is, you know, I don't think that's right at all. I think the whole point of the digital is that it is part of every aspect of our lives. And of course you can go in and there's all kinds of areas that could be just as affected as waterways, clean air, and so forth.
Now, who are, before we take a short break and then we can dig in deeper to your critique here, David, you know, who are the left, quote unquote, that you're thinking of when you level this concern at the left? Who are the left in your mind from a technology standpoint?
I think I'll answer that question a slightly different way. What I see happening is that a lot of the people who do not think of themselves as being on the right, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe, let's say, a lot of people who work for Google or Facebook or Twitter, but are not the bigwigs who often do tend to be on the right. They think they are working for social good. They think they are working for stuff like social justice that might be identified as left causes. And they don't, but because they have not been encouraged to sort of study and understand politics very well or very much, don't even really understand that they are actually, you know, to the SOPA and PIPA thing, to go to that since you raised it, right? I mean, as you said really wisely, right? I mean, SOPA and PIPA may not have been the right approaches to regulating copyright and so forth, right? But when you look at the people who contributed to that and what they said, especially the kids, right, the non-allied people who contributed to that effort, and you read the material about it, I was just reading some of it recently, I mean, you would think that what they did was equivalent to the civil rights marches in the 1960s. You know, they had somehow, and, you know, that to me is a kind of left impulse, that they had worked hard to, like, fix something in society that was absolutely, in, you know, really hurting people. And I don't think that SOPA and PIPA really qualify that way, right? I mean, that they're one side or another of a regulation. That might or might not have been bad or good. You know, that you see the same thing with net neutrality today, which is, you know, because of the name, is framed as a kind of moral cause. And when you look, at least to me, when I look at the details, I'm like, you're talking about one or another approach to structuring certain, you know, aspects of the network. I don't think it is a civil rights cause.
We're chatting with David Golumbia, a professor at Virginia Commonwealth University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU, which is Stanford's nonprofit, non-commercial radio station that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation at KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope you continue to do that, and along the lines of David's critique, I will tell you that KZSU is pretty much funded by itself. It's mostly member dues and whatever Stanford University throws its way by virtue of a building under a theater, and the wonderful work of Mark Lawrence, who has literally built the boards that operate KZSU and has been the mainstay through its existence. All right, so David, let me do some querying here as we think about this critique, and I think you've laid out, you know, some of the irksome structures and arguments that you've heard that go your way. And so let me ask you some tough and perhaps pushback questions to probe your critique here. So you know, the notion of cyber libertarianism to me, whenever I've thought about it, you know, I've thought heavily of, you know, the work of utopian theorists. And so, you know, utopian theorists who wrote about the perfect city 100 years ago, and who wrote about how to structure buildings and literally lay out cities by way of their roads and infrastructure to bring people together. You know, in large measure, I think, you know, certainly the narrative has been that utopian theorists theory from the early founders of the internet once it moved out of the DARPA world was really that notion of this freestanding, you know, interconnected network that would require very little in terms of regulation or government or even rules, right, in its earliest theoretical conception to be what it theoretically could be a free and open exchange and nodes of computers and so forth. So my question becomes, is cyber libertarianism merely a modern version of utopian theory, or is it something else?
Well, it's a wonderful topic that we could probably talk a lot about, but most of the utopians, part of what really concerns me is the lack of attention to the details of politics, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Most of the utopians were reading politics pretty thoroughly. I am not personally that much of a utopian, but I am happy to talk about, you know, positive directions that we might take society in. I have a little bit of sympathy with, like, real libertarians in the sense that I don't know how much planning, sort of advanced planning for how you want society to be mapped out has necessarily been all that effective. I am a little bit in favor of a more laissez-faire attitude within certain bounds that are usually set by regulation of various sorts. Utopianism, to me, it tends to not go in the direction that the utopians seem to think it's going to go in, which I think is it's an inherent problem in the way utopians often approach things. In a way, that is partly why in my current work, like, I am not quite so concerned with those people who openly identify as libertarians and explain their utopian ideals, like Peter Thiel, for example, or even Travis Kalanick or people like that. Like, you know, they're telling you what their politics are. You can agree with them or disagree with them. That's fine. I don't mostly agree with them, but at least they, you know, and frankly, they don't read enough. I mean, I still don't hear that in those ideas, like, a real understanding of where ideas like this have been tried before, what societies have looked like that have tried them, and so on. Be that as it may, what concerns me is when we don't have clarity about what the political goals are.
So let's talk about that, because the conflating of interest and, you know, the disparate alignment of groups that at least superficially wouldn't appear to be working together is certainly part of your critique, and I think it's an interesting one. And I will use, you know, this radio show as an example and want to get your reaction to it, right? And so Hearsay Culture runs through KZSU, but I also deliver it as a podcast through the Center for Internet Society, right? And I came to the Center for Internet Society in 2005 as a resident fellow. I launched the show there. I launched it because I wanted to get back into radio, having done it in high school, and I thought this would be a great place to do it, where I'm sitting at Stanford University and I've got brilliant, great people not only on the campus, but I could also get access to them by virtue of running the show through CIS and Stanford. And so off I go, right? A few years later, or actually, and I should take that back, during the time I was there, the Fair Use Project launched at CIS, which has been funded by Google. Okay, and so here's my question for you, right? So that information taken in of itself would suggest, right, without further probing, that, well, it must be that Dave's Hearsay Culture show, by virtue of the fact that I run it through Stanford, is in some way connected to Google, right? And that might be a fair inference to draw given that connection. The reality, however, is that it's not at all connected to Google. I've had critics of Google like Shiva Vaidyanathan and Frank, for that matter, on the show. I've never even given a second thought to the notion that Google would care or care less about anyone I have on the show, and I don't care whether they like it or not, and no one's ever suggested that I should, and I pick my own guests and so forth and so forth and so forth. And so here's my question, right? The alignment issue is one that certainly I think warrants attention, which is part of the reason why I'm thrilled that you're here, but how far does it get us? In other words, you know, if you start at a top level, the mere fact that entities that shouldn't apparently be working in concert doesn't necessarily mean that there will be a bad outcome. And I know you're not suggesting that that's always bad, but I'm curious if you could talk about or have a reaction to the question of at what point do you, as an analyst and as someone who is critiquing where we are, become concerned? What happens? And I'm using hearsay culture as an example. At what point would you be nervous about hearsay culture presenting itself in any other way than what I have just said?
Well, this is not a conspiracy theory, right?
And I want to be clear about that. I take this critique seriously, and I don't think that you're spinning wild tales of evil, which is why I'm saying I don't think in your writing you suggest that these are bad things. They're just things that we need to think about more critically, which is why I'm asking. Yeah.
And right now, it's clear in your question. Google does not go around policing what people, for the most part, does not go around policing what people say and do, even when it's to some extent on its own dime. And what doesn't concern me is when the goals of a project are very clear, as, for example, in the case of hearsay culture, it's very clear over the years that the point of your project is to have a wide range of points of view, and you are very committed to that, and it is evident in the show. And what would concern me, and which I think doesn't exist, would be a podcast that didn't make clear what its goals were, that maybe implied it was going to have a wide range of views, but then, you know, by the way, it turned out not to have a lot of critics on it, and maybe to have people who worked for some of these companies who didn't necessarily disclose their relationship with it. And to talk about an area where that does concern me is in the proliferation of so-called internet freedom groups, right? Mm-hmm. And internet freedom itself, which is really one of the most dominant sort of pieces of rhetoric in a lot of the non-governmental organizations and other civil society groups that kind of work in the internet space, right? And they're organized around this concept of internet freedom. And as quite a few critics have started to point out, internet freedom is just not a clear concept. It just isn't. It isn't clear in the same way that free speech is clear. You know, concepts that we have had hundreds of years to work on and that are grounded in a lot of very deep political thought, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly. Well, what is the relationship of quote-unquote internet freedom to those other freedoms? It's really not clear. And what happens then is that you get these organizations that, you know, put internet freedom in their title, and what they are up to is not clear, right? It just, and, you know, you talked about EFF, which is something I know, an organization that I think is very interesting, right? You put a little parenthesis there and you said on the left EFF, right? And mm-hmm. I have a lot of friends who feel that way, right? And I have a lot of friends who give money to the ACLU, which they feel is a left organization, which is, you know, for the most part true, but not entirely true. But the ACLU has a very clear commitment to a single interpretation of the First Amendment, right? And we could dig into the cases that the ACLU has filed and dig into their statements, and for the most part, their position is quite clear. EFF, I don't understand what its position is, right? When I dig into their case law, sometimes they're on one side, sometimes they're on another side of cases. What principle is it that that organization is about? And if you read their material, the principle is internet freedom, but as I've said, I don't think internet freedom is a clear concept. I think it is a vague concept. And therefore, you know, the fact that EFF has gotten a lot of its funding from some of the major technology corporations, the fact that some of the people who founded it are people like John Perry Barlow, have pretty far right views. And yet that group is often taken to be a left group. And I think that is partially because its politics really aren't clear. And that does disturb me. And it does disturb me that they often appear to be supporting industry positions in a way that doesn't seem like what the ACLU does, for example, right? The ACLU really seems concerned about free speech. And, you know, I've gotten into sometimes unpleasant arguments with people from EFF, and I've said, just tell me what the principle is that your organization advocates.
And what's been the response to that question?
They'll say, it's obvious, just read our case law. Mm-hmm. And then I'll say, but if I go to ACLU, they can tell me it's an absolutist, you know, support for the First Amendment. Okay.
So let me attempt to surmise a principled response to that critique. In other words, let me attempt to answer your question. And of course, I'm not speaking on behalf of VFF here, obviously. So I could see the response in effect being this: EFF is focused on making sure that technology itself remains available to all. Okay, and that the infrastructure itself remains one that is accessible to all and can be used by all, meaning that any particular interest group that would attempt to embed its value structure in the network itself, we would be opposed to, which might explain why EFF would align itself, at least in terms of its positions, with entities like Google, because Google, of course, has built a very successful business around these, you know, intellectual property and other concept defenses, in other words, ways to do the permissionless innovation, if you will, on the IP side, and I recognize that you've defined it more broadly, that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. So I'm imagining that response. It's certainly, I think, my conception as if I think about what does EFF stand for, is that a satisfying response to you?
First of all, I think that is a fair response. I do think that is what they would say. I would note that it is much longer than an absolutist interpretation of the First Amendment, and it has a lot of clauses in it, and I'm not sure it's possible to phrase it without a lot of those clauses. And I think a lot of those, how we interpret and understand a lot of the clauses that you put in there actually are not clear. Mm-hmm. And what it means to have equal access, what it means to be accessible, what it means for different parties to have access and so forth, these are really nuanced issues that I'm not sure how, let's put it this way. The First Amendment is not just important as an absolute in itself, it is enshrined in human rights law, right? It is a very important thing as we understand it for sort of the very idea of civil society. The principles you just articulated, which depending on their interpretation may or may not be ones that I agree with, I have trouble plugging those into like the UN Declaration on Human Rights. Mm-hmm. But the rhetoric of EFF and people like it suggests that it is absolutely vital in the same way free speech is. You know, you can, it's not hard to find rhetoric and slogans online and off that are, you know, the internet, the right to the internet is as fundamental a right as, you know, the right to speech and assembly. And my view is, in most cases, it simply is the right to speech and assembly, in which case it's already covered by that stuff. And then I ask, well, what do we need EFF for? I mean, ACLU actually does defend a lot of these sort of free speech online issues, often allied with the EFF, right? And I kind of lose track then of what is your special niche here? Which human right are you protecting?
I'm sorry, David, go ahead, yeah.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say we're chatting with David Columbia at Virginia Commonwealth University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, by way of a follow-up, David, although I think I interrupted maybe the end of your answer, you know, along those very lines, and we're getting close to, as you're familiar with, the unfair portion of the show, although you may have thought this whole interview was unfair depending on, you know, the direction it's gone, hopefully not, but we're now in about 10 minutes left, which I'll still give you some time on. In the same, Jacobin piece, which I highly recommend, and again, entitled Cyber Libertarians, Digital Deletion of the Left. You write, and this is a quote, the view that code will save the world, and that's a quote within the quote, makes most forms of direct political engagement unnecessary or even unwelcome. These cultural politics are anathema to leftist concerns with social equality, yet such technological solutionism, and that's a defined term as well, to which you have a hyperlink, is still seen by many on the left as emblematic of genuinely leftist political thinking, not the retrograde movement it actually is. And I think you're alluding to it here. And the critique that there isn't enough discussion of the meta operations of government and policymaking such that that, you know, if you're actually attempting to affect a solution, you kind of need to know how, another trite phrase, how the sausage is made, I think is one that resonates. One of the challenges here, which I want to get your reaction to, and it alludes to it in these, you know, I'm using this phrase, not you, these, you know, unholy alliances, if you will, you know, is the problem of expertise in government. And this is something I focused on increasingly on Hearsay Culture. And in this case, it happens to dovetail with some of the work I do, because I think it's so critically important, so not well understood. And the problem is this, and I want to get your reaction to it from a cyber libertarianism and why are you here perspective. In order to get the experts who actually know how to write good policy into government, they will, by definition, and this is the same issue that and critique that comes up with banking regulation as well, they by definition will have to be people who were inside industry. Now, people like Senator Warren have said, not really, right? They don't actually have to have those connections in order to write good policy. But I'm curious whether you see the cyber technology and internet world as similar to that. In other words, and the point being this, right? The pushback would be, well, sure, you're going to have people from Google and Yahoo and Cisco and so forth who are going to then have the levers of access inside policymaking, because they're the ones that know how the system works and how are you going to regulate otherwise. So what's your response to this, I think, you know, perhaps growing revolving door, if you will, between private industry, civil society, and now I'm going to add in the government itself?
Well, you know, you've identified one of the major problems in governance today in general, right? And it's something that Larry Lessig has been trying to work on with his concern about money in government, right? And absolutely, in the financial industry, it is an enormous problem, right? And maybe particularly in the financial industry, regulatory capture and the cycle of people working for the industry that they need to be in order to understand it, and then coming back and working for the regulators. This is, honestly, I think this is one of the deepest challenges to democratic governance that has ever existed and that exists in the world today. And it requires a lot of thought. And I don't want to suggest that I have solutions to it, you know, off the top of my head, or as a, you know, as a sort of isolated thinker working on this. But I do think that the view that the experts in government need to be, the view that governmental regulators at some level need to actually be experts in the technology, I think is double-sided. It's true on the one hand, right? We do need, for example, at the FDA, we have to have doctors who understand how medical decisions are made and how medical technology works. And at the same time, we also have to have experts in politics who understand how regulations operate in general, right? I mean, you might even call them bureaucrats. One of the things that I would want to focus on in this particular area is there is a lot of discussion among people who are digital experts, let's say a lot of disparagement among those people of government for not being technical experts. And that's where I start to get very worried, right? It is not hard to find people openly mocking politicians and among some of the communities who I consider to be worrisome to me about cyber libertarian politics, where they just routinely mock the Supreme Court, Congress, you know, the executive branch for not being experts in digital technology. And to me, that is a kind of, what I feel really happening there is a kind of disparagement of the product of governance itself. And that kind of builds on itself. And I think we see it all over the place in a lot of areas we haven't talked about, like Bitcoin and like the Snowden revelations and so forth, where there's a real love of sort of disparaging government. And to me, government is its own area of expertise, right? Especially if we look at like judging. Judging is its own area of expertise. And I think to move out of regulation for a second, you know, judges have to make decisions about technical matters all the time from a variety of technical fields. They clearly can't be experts in those fields, right? They have to be experts in the law. That is the way our system is structured. You know, they should be able to consult experts to help them, but they have expertise that is absolutely important, right? And it's an expertise in judging. And I praise that, right? I think that is disparaging, that really concerns me. And that's, you know, exactly how we manage the circulation of people from inside and outside of industries that are being regulated. That is a problem that I hope a lot more people are going to spend time working on, because it is a major, major problem.
So and I want to ask you as my last question in a moment, David, about your current book project, which ties directly to this. But before we do, so I'll ask kind of the, you know, I like the word takeaway. It's helpful, but I don't mean this as a takeaway question, but it's going to sound like it. So given all of the concerns that you've written about in these pieces, as well as your own blog on computing.org, as well as your book, Cultural Logic of Computation, where you explore some of these issues as well, you know, what would be your biggest concern about government and its ability to understand the state of cyber libertarianism today? Right? If you're going to go in and do a tutorial for policymakers, right? And by the way, I'll include not just government but private policymakers, because as you talk about, right, a lot of this policy is coming not only directly out of private industry but driven by private industry. And I don't mean that necessarily in a nefarious way. What would be your biggest concern about government's ability to understand the issues that you raise today?
I would encourage government officials to not accept the claim that they don't know what they're doing, right? And I would encourage them, you know, if I have a takeaway, it's that I wish people who want to affect political change would study politics a lot more carefully and then be explicit about what political change they are hoping to have happen. And part of the effect of that would be, I think, to have a little bit more respect for the, as you've hinted, you know, extremely ugly process of the sausage making of politics. It is ugly. It's unpleasant. It's inefficient, right? Which is something that something we haven't talked about, like the Code for America and civic hacking people seem to promote the idea that like government is inefficient and therefore bad and the enemy, and what we want to do is streamline it and make it work. And I think actually I want those people to appreciate why government is inefficient. It is kind of meant to be inefficient. We have to make difficult decisions that are not easily arrived at and that we aren't all going to agree upon, right? I mean, I think that is a basic fact of democracies, is we have to come to agreements, to come to political decisions that we are not all going to agree upon, and then we have to live with them. And that's part of why it has to be inefficient.
David, as we close here, and it's fascinating stuff, and of course, you're invited back on the show to continue this discussion, particularly as your book, which I'm going to ask about now, which you're working on now. Tell us in the remaining couple of minutes that we have a bit about this book project, and I won't pin you down to a date when we can actually read it.
The project, which is called Cyber Libertarianism, and currently has a subtitle, How the Digital Revolution Tilts Right, is, you know, it's trying to collect a lot of the thought that people have had about cyber libertarianism. It talks quite a bit about how it is that the kind of, let's say, the 60s revolutionary, 60s sort of lefty revolutionaries got kind of absorbed into Silicon Valley, which is a story that's been told by quite a few journalists and even the filmmaker Adam Curtis in his wonderful three-part documentary, all watched over by Machines of Loving Grace. Fred Turner, the Stanford communication scholar, has written about it a little bit. I try to talk in some pretty significant detail about the relationship of the different political schools that are under here, like libertarianism with a capital L and Hayek and Murray Rothbard and people like that, and then the sort of the politics that doesn't appear to know its own name that goes under cyber libertarianism. And then I mostly try to look at current examples of especially rhetoric and discourse, the way people talk about the digital revolution that are occurring today. I talk about Bitcoin a fair amount because I think Bitcoin, the rhetoric surrounding Bitcoin, you have to be somebody like me who is fascinated by the right wing, but what people write about Bitcoin could come out of pamphlets from the John Birch Society from the 1950s. And, I, you know, in many ways, I think it has. But the people who write it clearly don't know that. They think they are a lot of them don't know it. One of the major topics that I discuss in the book is the idea that the internet revolution is the second coming of the print revolution, which is something that you see talked about a lot in some of the sort of pro-technology pundits like Clay Shirky and Jeff Jarvis, who again are figures where their politics aren't so clear, and that's part of what worries me about some of what people like them say. I think that the comparison between the internet and the print revolution is frankly more mystifying and problematic than it is helpful, for a lot of reasons I won't go into. And then I try to talk, you know, somewhat directly about the political philosophical consequences of some of this material. What do we want freedom to mean, right? What is, you know, even in that phrase internet freedom, what does freedom mean, and what does it look like if we focus on the equality considerations that I think, you know, I'm not opposed to that sort of economic freedom idea, right? But I think it has to be balanced with these equality and sort of social freedom ideas, right? And I try to think about how could we get more of that thinking into the discussions of the digital.
Professor David Golumbia of Virginia's Commonwealth University, author of the article Cyber Libertarians, Digital Deletion of the Left, and author of the forthcoming book on this issue. Thank you so much for joining us today on the show. This is a fascinating critique. I think it's very important work, whether one's reading it as a mirror or not. I think it's incredibly useful, and I thank you for taking the time today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been very enjoyable.
So alluding to a guest that we've talked about a few times in this interview, I want to mention an upcoming guest for this fall quarter on KZSU's calendar for Hearsay Culture. And sure enough, next week, Professor Frank Pasquale of Maryland, author of the forthcoming book, The Black Box Society, Technologies of Search, Reputation, and Finance. Frank's going to be on again. He's been on the show a few times already. My colleague, Megan Squire of Elon's Computer Science Department on Open Source Data Mining. Professor Stephen Turner of the University of South Florida on technological and scientific expertise in policymaking and democracy. Coming up in mid-November, Professors Alexander Glazer and Zia Meon of Princeton University, co-authors of the book Unmaking the Bomb, A Fissile Material Approach to Nuclear Disarmament and Nonproliferation. Professor Ed Felton, who runs the Center for Information Technology Policy, of which I am now affiliated, and then Lorelei Kelly of the New America Foundation on Technology and Legislative Decision-Making. And rounding out this quarter, Professor Danielle Citron of the University of Maryland School of Law, author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Because, of course, Election Day is coming up and politics are getting much more attention during this time of year, whether we like it or not, I'm doing a few more shows this quarter on policymaking and that process that I think is critical, and so look for those shows as things go forward. I am, despite that, always looking at future guests that I can get on the show. In fact, I'm reaching out to some people for the winter quarter on KZSU's schedule, which will begin after the holidays in January 2015. As always, you can reach me and offer suggestions and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. You can also listen to the show a number of ways. This quarter, the show will be on at 10 a.m. Pacific time Thursday mornings on KZSU FM Stanford, which you can stream at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, by going to the iTunes page for CIS. There's an interesting story there as well with regard to CIS's partnering with Apple to form that page back in the days when digital rights management was very active and kind of new. And maybe I'll share that story in the future and talk about that a bit. Or you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous guests, the upcoming schedule, and at this point, the show that I've recorded today with David is show number 222. So you can get all 221 prior shows by going to the Listen tab at hearsayculture.com. Again, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Because of my work this year at Princeton, I'm going to avail myself of the fact that I will be physically present on and off on a campus which has an amazing array of scholars and others who show up. And so I'm going to be running around there with my mobile recorder, recording interviews, including with Ed in mid-November and with Professors Glazer and Meon. So if and by some chance you have anyone at Princeton that you think I should be talking to, now would be a good time to email me that as well at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining us today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.